Hello and welcome to episode 37 of Live at the Backyard Comedy Club podcast.
Woo!
We're back. We had a wee break. Sorry about that.
David's been all busy with his movie. Lord Fondleroy trouncing around the country, showing off, winning awards.
I'd like to argue, but that is what I've been doing.
Best bikini wax in movie.
Yes, so we're back, and we had the wonderful Quincy on the show, local boy to the East End. Brilliant comedian. I've gigged with Quincy for nearly a decade, and I've never seen him have a bad gig. You should check him out. Did you enjoy meeting
Very
Mr.
much
Quincy?
Enjoyed it. We got to talk about writing for television as well, which Quincy is now doing.
He's a lifelong friend of Idris Elba, and he was working on his recent project as both a writer and an actor, and it was interesting to...
Very good show, and worth checking out. But why listen to us talk about it now when you could be listening to Quincy talk about it later on the podcast?
Enjoy. Release the terabytes!
No.
You're a local, aren't you? Just up the road, Stratford or
Cantown? Cantown, yeah. Cantown. I'm literally, my mum is literally 5 minutes from Mr. Innocent. Jeff.
Jeff's been on the pod.
Yeah, so 5 minutes from him. I trained with Ricky Grover. Ricky Grover's old cronies, Jimmy's.
Is he back gigging again, Ricky?
I haven't seen him. Last time I was in here.
Oh, really?
He asked me for a benefit.
Right.
A benefit gig of me, him, Joe Brand, and a few others.
Oh, yeah,
he's a patriot. He's a patriot for this organisation in Cannon Town, where he's from. So he asked me to do it. I said, yeah, I'll do it.
Because Ricky was the king of the circuit.
Really?
He was massive when I started, both in presence and physicality.
Height-wise, width-wise?
All
above.
All five dimensions.
He's a legend in the gym I am.
Really?
Everyone loves him.
Oh, wow.
And he's a decent boxer.
Really? For a big guy as well?
He was good level.
Oh.
Good level, so he's a decent boxer, he can handle himself.
Jeez, that's devastating.
Yeah, he might be big, he's big, but he's got good, I've been told he's got good hands. So the last time I had a good conversation, he goes, oh yeah, when you're ready, just let me know. Goes, yeah, all right. I won't go easy. Yeah.
You took up boxing because of the...
the boxing, I took it up. I've always been a fan of boxing. And then when I reached 40 years old, I said, you know what? I want every year, in January, to do something out of my comfort zone. So, you know, you get those people, oh yeah, you should do that. I said, I'm tired, I'm talking it. So I had diabetes. I found I had diabetes. So I was going through weight loss stuff, and I said, you know what? It ain't like I ain't known in my area. So I basically said, I'm going to box. And the fight I want to do is I'm going to raise the money I'll get. I give to ACLT, which is the African Caribbean League Hema Trust. Yeah, and I took up the boxing. It was mainly to do with me got diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. I did balloon up to a big old weight. And I've fought ever since.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I ain't like professional, you know what I mean? Unlicensed, white collar, but I mean, I'm a decent of a standard.
Yeah. Do you find that the training's the easiest way to maintain?
There's no training out there. If you want to lose weight like that, box. Boxing training is the best training in the world.
I'd recommend it highly. I used to be 22 stone. I used to be a big, big guy. I was always big, never been fit or anything. And then I got into boxing, and that's what trimmed all the weight down.
Yeah.
No fit. And it's fun,
right? It is, yeah. I got to 20. It's hard, but it is fun. Yeah. I got to 23, touching 24.
Oh.
But I was agile for my size, but I've always, I had it in my belly, belly, you know what I mean? And I looked at a picture of when I first started stand up, you know, it's like, I was sitting down and it was literally, I looked like Jabba the Hutt. fuck. I was wearing his t-shirt and I was like, I don't know, who told me to tuck it in? Who told the fat guy to tuck in the t-shirt?
See, I've been fat my whole life, so I knew that it's all about draping. Long and drops, that's the only way to really hide it.
I was like, this is going to be the goth look for a little while. But yeah, I tucked in this, because I got this belt, this big buckle belt. I like big buckle belts. Mm. Must be my fan of WWE days.
Who's your wrestler? Who was your wrestler?
Who was my wrestler back in the day? Well, when I first started watching it, it was Hulk Hogan was like the big one, but I would say Stone Cold.
Really, you were Stone Cold? I was the Dwayne the Rock Johnson guy.
I did like him, but it was just something. Stone Cold reminded me of the white guys in my area. It was a bit racist, but if they knew you, you were right.
The racist you can handle.
The racist, like, you know what I mean? It was like pick and choosey racy.
Aren't nearly all racists like that? They're sort of like, they're racist about people they don't know. Well, not Jimmy. He's one of us.
That's why. I always say that when you actually, you could come, like, growing up in the area in Kennington, it was notorious. Growing up, you might say, that's racist. And there were racist incidences, but, like, I never encountered it because I knew them. I went to school with their sons, and it was like, it was just my mates. And it's only when I really only started to see the ignorance is when I left primary school, and then obviously that people split, and then the environment you live in. But the area I lived was quite tight. Everybody, I mean, there was that old, we play football, it was blacks versus whites. It was blacks versus whites when I was growing up. Everything we done was like,
I assume sports you won.
Most of the time, So,
when was this? What sort of years was this?
So this was like early 80s.
Early 80s?
Because I was born 71. So like growing up, like late 70s, early 80s. I'll never forget the day I was playing out with my mates, and it was 81, and it was the first time I really knew about West Ham, but I was never really a West Ham, I was never a West Ham fan, because I knew the kind of people who supported them in my area, and it was like, there was different parts of the area, which is like, I don't like that area. And like, I can't support, if you support them, well, I don't like you, so.
You're not my tribe.
There was all this, I was with my mates, and basically all these like, ICF guys were like saying, oh, West Ham, shouting that stuff, and they were shouting that racist stuff. I mean, we was playing football, blacks versus whites, and they were shouting that racist stuff. But that was the only time I really experienced it. But even then, the white guys who was playing with us, they was like, no, these are our blacks. Picking your own.
It's weird when they connect with actual real world empathy, like, oh, but they don't connect that with the rest of their races.
Do you know what? And I always say this, I say this now, it's easy in hindsight, is that conversation and dialogue is an amazing thing. I watched this documentary one time with the Black Panther movement. They were getting bigger because one of the guys, Huey, was going down to Deep South. Because, you know, I believe that governments pitch people against each other.
Controlled opposition.
That's right. So they would tell the poor working class white that it's the blacks or vice versa. So while they're arguing, they're doing what they're doing. And he tapped in, and the Black Panther guys tapped into having dialogue with like the rednecks in the South, and in a weird way, watch that documentary. Really, it was like a bit like my childhood in a sense, because I'll be out with my friends, some of my black mates, and we go to different areas, and you see these white guys, and they're like, all right, Quince, and they were like, how do you know him? And I was like, oh, go in his house, that's my son or so. You know, but he's notoriously NF, and it was hard for me to really believe them, my mates, because I've had these people know my mum, they know my dad. Like, my dad was like a gambling man, and he's my mum was like a nurse, but whenever someone had an accident, like it was obviously wasn't surgery, but if it's like first aid, everyone knocks on my mum's door, regardless of colour, and Nurse Broom, she would sort it out. So I never saw it. It just showed me that watching that Black Panther show, dialogue is an amazing thing. If you just talk to someone, okay, how ignorant you are. I'm not saying you have to agree, but if we have a disagreement about something, 9 times out of 10, from my experience, there's someone who's probably trying to control it, who's probably making us argue the way
we do. Even if you don't resolve your difference, it's impossible to ignore each other's humanity.
Yes.
And racism comes from objectifying others. They're not humans, they're others.
Yeah.
And if you start talking man to man, even if you politically still think that there's some economical reason why you think that there shouldn't be migrants or whatever, you're still not going to be able to avoid the humanity of the man you're talking to, and therefore it becomes a human thing rather than an object.
Yeah, no, you're right. And it really did open my eyes, because I found myself growing up falling into that trap of, like, when the Asian community was prominent and even the African community, when Roots came on TV, it was like I was saying derogatory things towards African people. You know what I mean? If I got upset or just laughing and joking, where you might think, look at me now, like I'm sporting a friggin' an African.
Couldn't be more onside.
to my ancestry. You know what I mean? It just shows that, I mean, obviously, as comedians, we travel, so we get to experience and we meet different people from walks of life. And I suppose I'm more of a bit of a classist. If I see a middle class or posh person, my back will probably go up.
I'm quite similar, like having grown up complete working class background, despite my general appearance and voice. I've realised this recently that no one has any idea that I'm actually from a very working class. Yeah. Like my family are Greeks and Italians, and fully working class. And it's like that's probably where I still have some prejudice, which is more class based. But I think that's where the real problems are.
It's
class, and then there's these excuses of it being, you know, racism, sexism, and then people battling each other, and left and right as well. That's another one.
Yeah,
no one's actually listening to each other enough to go.
Well, the left and the right, it's weird for me. The left and the right is like they both need each other.
Yeah, to balance each other out.
They don't realise it. Mm-hmm. They are the original war of the roses. It's like, you know what, deep down, you really do like each other. But you just don't want to admit it.
Yeah. it's like Steptoe and Son.
Yeah. So
you filthy old conservatives.
Well, I'd argue that we don't really have a left wing party to choose in the UK.
No,
because I mean, even with Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party is controlled opposition. You know, it's that especially post Tony Blair, you know, it's all centrist, it's all, you know, different shades of Tory blue, frankly. Lenin said of the British Labour Party, he said that a socialist solution has to come from below. The problem with the Labour Party is it's a solution from above. They're Hampstead champagne socialists, the Milibands, and they're all you know, very well-heeled individuals. They're not really socialist. They're just not really evil. they're just not being evil isn't enough.
As you mentioned, that the Jeremy Corbyn thing, it's like, obviously, as a politician, he's the one. Everybody's Jeremy Corbyn bandwagon. And he's the first politician my children have actually spoken about.
Really?
He's the best we've had for a while, but he's still a bit,
obviously, I agree and I agree with some of the stuff he says, but then the other stuff is like, well, how are you going to do it?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, you make sense. How you gonna do it? But we live in a time now where a lot of younger voters and younger people go by popularity, and I believe that the Blair got in through popularity. Mm. Obama's got through popularity, and it's like a personality now. Obviously, Trump is that thing. But going back to with the Corbyn, like with him, I've grown up with politics from the days of Spitting Image, which was my introduction to light politics, which was the human side of it, which I think was a fantastic program.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shame that this program wasn't continued.
I don't know why it started today.
Well, it stopped because once we got career politicians that went Eton, Oxford, the Houses of Parliament, they all looked and sound the same. So the creators of Spitting Image had nothing to work with. When politicians were all sort of ex-army officers or ex-masters of industry, there were these real characters that Spitting Image could go to town with. But once we basically got all these essentially legs of ham in a suit, there was nothing for them to create, and they sort of like just ran aground. Now I think we're getting a little bit more back of character back into it, but I don't. It's very difficult. I started off stand up wanting to be a political comic, but I find audiences don't often want to hear. They go, out to forget about how shit things are, David. Just tell us a joke about your dick.
But do you find that? I find, and you say that from a political point of view. I mean, as a comedian, as a black comedian, I mean, I talk about cultural issues or to do with race. People come to the comedy clubs now for an escapism, so to speak. Unless they come to see you specifically, like Andy Parsons or something like that, who you know as a political comedian. But I think people are like, is that that Christmas party where you don't really want to show yourself in front of your work colleagues? So like, I love political comedians, especially I think that the John Olivers of this world, who've Trevor Noahs, who have made, obviously we understand that their stuff is written and it's crafted, but just the fact that they can make politicians who are supposed to be leading us into the right directions look so silly, and they're not even like taking the piss. They're just pointing at things.
John Oliver's fantastic at it. The way that he takes a TV show and half of it is just essentially a deep dive into something that is currently wrong with politics or a system. It's just incredible the way he conveys it with comedy, because comedy is just an assist, right, to get people to listen.
Yeah,
and it's like a TED talk. It's just fantastic.
I think I started to listen to him and watch his show. I watched him one time speak about the FIFA scandal, but he spoke about one of the FIFA delegates from Trinidad. Now, when I see a white guy berating a black guy, my ears prick, and I'm like, oh, where's he going with this? It was so true. And it was so funny. It was like, man, my fucker ain't got, like, he's got a point.
It's not very good. Sometimes you just can't do it. So,
mate, you're a Trini dick, mate. You're a Trini daddy. Stick to cricket. And I think, like, what you're going back when comedians, when you talk about political stuff, I think there's some audiences, like I said, you have to build your own audience for that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, sometimes, I mean, when you do somewhere like an art centre in Winchester, and somebody will say, well, they're very middle class, so they might not like the filth. I find that's a place that you have to do the most filth.
I find with me, I tend to go with the swing political wise. Like, I'm currently talking about the Windrush.
All right.
Situation.
Yeah.
I got into a I want to call it a disagreement, but
is that where the heritage of your own family comes?
Yeah, from? Barbados. So that indirectly, it just missed my mum and dad's generation. So it would be my cousins and uncles. My mum actually flew here. So my dad came through the army. My mum flew. It's the light boats. So she came as a nurse. But it hit me because I know a lot of my mum's generation was built the NHS.
Uh-huh.
And
you are presently involved in a TV show with Idris Elba, and that's involved in the Windrush generation as well, is it not?
I wouldn't say it's based in the 80s, mid-80s. So Idris's family's African.
No, it's all right.
It's a real lookalike. Sorry. Yes.
We won't have that kind of thing on our podcast,
no. Hashtag sorry. Not sorry.
No, Idris's family were probably so the next wave of immigrants. So Africans came with the Indians, probably on the back of King of Scotland. What's your name again? Idi Amin.
Oh, Idi Amin.
Idi Amin era. So in the long run, is more of a case of it's based on Idris's dad's, his uncle. It's his uncle who came over to his country. Idris's dad was the first one to come over here, and it's basically follows the journey of his uncle finding himself in the UK, and it shows that how people from another world, another country, have a view of what England is. They don't realise that England is broken up into different parts. So you live, they think that we all live in Buckingham Palace and
right, sure.
We all like, and
in a village just outside.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's like
a village green, a little church.
Yeah, so with that show, it is the goodness, the greatness about that show. It really brings back a lot of memories, and there isn't. I'm not just saying this, but there's no colour divide in this, because it shows how we, as people from working class backgrounds, handled things and got along, and how the pub was a community. It was a community. People didn't just go in there for drink and get smashed off their face. They went in there and they socialised. And
that's why that pubs were put onto estates as well. You know, you see a block of a tab block and it will have a pub built into it, because people that the sort of like social engineers of the sort of the champagne socialists of Hampstead realised that, you know, you couldn't just build 500 units and expect them not to have somewhere that they can all go. And now you've got the Tories essentially trying to desperately make it impossible for anybody who isn't in the 1% to drink outside their own house, because it makes the streets so terrible if you've got all the poor people enjoying themselves.
Whenever
a pub closes down and becomes a Lambrooks or luxury flats, it's never going back.
Yeah,
that's something that's communities lost forever.
And there's one thing I realised from the programme as well. It was the common denominator of every walks of life and culture, that how powerful drink really is. You know, it doesn't matter where you are. If you want to have the right and the left, they will come together with a drink. And then they will have their debates.
It breaks down barriers.
It breaks down barriers, that's right.
That's why I need it to dance. But I recently watched the show, and it's very good. And it's exactly what you said, in that it captures that community so well at a time. You said it brings back memories. And as an outsider, having never experienced that, you can tell watching it that it brings back memories, because it feels like you're gaining memories. It's so of that time. It has such a feel to it that you can really sense how that was. You know, obviously Bill Bailey's in it as well, and the relationship
that Idris and him have
is fantastic.
Yeah, and that was Bill Bailey was a neighbour similar to my mum and dad's. And I think what I love about the show, how the show starts off with Idris's character, he plays his dad, writes a letter to his mum and sends money. And that's what my mum and dad used to do. They used to write letters and post it all. £5 or £10, where you can actually put money into a letter and it is to get there. I remember, I don't know you guys, but I remember when I first got a letter and it had money in it.
So, yeah.
You can even think about doing that now.
When I was young, it was always sort of, you'd occasionally receive money in a letter, maybe for a birthday, but there was always that, oh, don't send money in a letter, it won't get there. That was always the feel.
But
I love that about Sherwood. It's always a random amount of money, like £6.50.
New shoes.
I remember I used to get from like aunts a card that had like three little plastic popper. Things that they could press in a pound coin.
So
you get £3 coins pressed into your birthday card.
So what are you doing on the show then? Are you working on the second season?
Well, the part I play is a barman. I play Frank, a guy called Frank, just runs the local bar in the area. I'm not too sure if there's talks of a second season, but from the feedback I've got, I honestly feel why there shouldn't be a second season. A lot of people have said to me they enjoyed it so much, it finished too quick. There's only 6 episodes.
Yeah.
Because we live in an age now where people are not going to come back every week and watch the same program. Mm-hmm. They watched it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you've got time to spare, they just watch the whole box.
It's a very strange turn that television's taken, that they now dump all, you know, here's 32 episodes, they're all there for you now,
well, they're doing a mix now, so they dump some, and more British companies broadcasters are doing that, so they'll dump some all at once while still having the weekly stuff. As you see, Netflix also is starting to introduce weekly things, so they're offering something to everyone, and it gives them a good testing ground to see what works better.
Because I noticed that with Power, the program 50 Cent's Power, that was a weekly, which was similar to The Wire, which was my son.
Is it good, The Power?
I've never watched it. So that was why The Power was on the back of Empire. And you had The Wire, obviously, was massive, which was always also in. That was to come on weekly, but it is a case of, testing ground, because I watched... my first box set I watched was Prison Break.
That was your first box set? I went back to that. Mine was Breaking Bad.
That was your first box
set? Because I'd watch everything else as it came out, and then, suddenly I was like, I'm just going to box set something that was Breaking Bad.
Yeah, for me, Prison Break, I watched that like 2-3 years after it. Obviously, it was the hype.
But that's the thing now. I came to The Sopranos really late. And
me as well.
I'm only just getting through Sopranos now. I'm on season 4. I am having the best time.
It's
the best thing I've seen since The Wire.
You know what? King Lear is the best thing I've watched. It's the best thing
King
since.
King Lear ain't got nothing on Sopranos or The Wire.
My first box set was 6 Feet Under.
Who's that?
It was the two brothers that inherited a...
the funeral home.
Funeral home, yeah. And it was the guy who went on to Dexter's break.
Oh, okay. One thing I will say though, on the back of doing the show in the long run, it's given me a massive bug for, because I helped write the show, I was like an advisor for some of the scripts.
Oh, that's nice.
Like, add jokes and stuff like that, and it gave me a feel of what a script's about.
Tell the story fully. How did it come to you for I've heard you tell the story, so you know it just from your childhood, right?
So me and Idris was, or is, my cousin's best friend.
Mm.
They were the same age. So Idris came to Canning Town, he's originally from Hackney, but he came to Canning Town around 11, 12 years old. So Idris was in the class of my cousin. Me and my cousin used to go walk home because we lived around the corner of each other. And from school days, I was like the older one, and we just got on. All of us got on and we went to school, and then I went to Barking College and he attended after. And then our passion was music, and we played music together, and we just became very tight. And like, he's my children's godfather.
Oh, nice.
We just thick as thieves. I remember when he said, I'm going to America. And I was like, we had no friends, like, who had that thought of like shipping up. I remember when he had, like when he was going into the acting, and he was getting roles here. He did a show here on Channel 4 back in the day called Ultraviolet, which he had a big screening for, and I watched it. It was really great. And he's doing a lot of plays in London. I watched his plays, supporting him his plays. While he was doing that, I was DJing. Went into comedy then. Liked it, weren't really into comedy, just DJed. And we played it twice as nice. And then one day he was getting his roles, and he was seeing a girl, a mutual friend of ours. And he was doing his children's program. And then one day he just said, you know what, I'm going to America. And I was like, yeah, all right. And then he basically, there's one thing about Idris, I will say that, it might be because he's a single child. So he's very, like, it's nothing like my brother or my sister. He's just like, he just goes and does it.
Yeah.
And that's something which I've never really been like, because I've always had younger brothers. And he went out there for a little while, came back, went out there for longer, came back, and that was it. And then we DJed at a party one time, and he's like, yeah, that's it. I'm off. So you've got his, I never really took it serious. And he's like, I've got my green card. And I was like, you're right, okay. Suspecting I'd be out there for a few months and be back. And then like, a year later, I was like, what the fuck is he? Yeah, and then we baked the DJ at Lennox Lewis's party one time. And I'm not going to go too deep into what happened, but. He went out
that here. Couldn't have sounded more shady.
Yeah, yeah.
Trust me, he more incriminated me than he incriminated you. Yeah, and then
he was DJing at Lennox.
We both were. Wow. It was in a place in Carnaby Street, a club in Carnaby Street, and then Twice as Nice, and then he went to America. And that was it for good, and we were just speaking on the phone. Mm. And stuff like that, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't see him as often, but I spoke to him the other day for my son's birthday. But it was he called me because I didn't even know he'd done this. In the long run, was originally a short film.
Was it?
Yeah.
Ah, right. Because so I was wondering where it came from.
It was a short film he put together.
Yeah.
And I think he was probably testing out his directorial
chops.
Yeah, because he's obviously doing Yard, you know, which is in Sundance and finished this year. So he asked me, he got one of his people to call me. That's when I realised, he actually my friend. I've never looked at Idris as, he's my boy, my brethren, but I've never looked at him as Hollywood. We haven't got that relationship.
Mm.
We don't talk shop, yeah. I mean, around, so. It was when one of his people called me, and I say one of his people. Who's this? Quince. Oh yeah, it's just one of you. I can look at the script. A lady called Anna, really lovely lady, works for a production company, and she asked me to look at the script, and just to see what kind of jokes you could add to it, a bit more punchy and all that. And the rest is history.
So they brought you in as basically a comedy consultant on the script.
And then I noticed there were no Caribbean people in it.
In the show?
In the show, yeah. It makes sense because it was about his family.
Yeah, I suppose.
So it was, and then that's when I realised again, my mate, he actually is big shit because he told him to write me in the part. And he wrote me in the part. Nice. So there was, he wrote me in the part, there was two characters in there. And he basically told them to amalgamate them into one and gave it to me.
That's nice. Really good.
So I was like, oh, fucking hell.
But it's giving you the writing bug now. Have you got a feel for...
Yeah, and it actually helped my stand-up in those ways as well, because that was the first time I sat in a room, because I've had some writing stuff. I've worked into a writer's room since then, with it. And it's the first time I've actually been in the writer's room amongst writers, because the stand-ups, we just... Whatever comes in our head, we write down and we jot down. But we're never in a room to sit down and work out A plots, B plots, C plots. And my new word now is what's the emotional arc of the character and the character's backlog, and I was like, fuck. And then it's actually helped me in my stand up.
Really?
I would say I've always been a roughly storyteller anyway, but now when I write down something and I deliver it, I want the joke to have a start, middle, and end. If it's
right, yeah.
If it's 2 minutes, it's gonna have a start, middle, and end. So when I spoke about the Windrush the last week, it wasn't just like it's a gag, typical gag about the Windrush and oh yeah, full of shit. I went in and I spoke about it from my parents' point of view and what my parents contributed towards the country, and then it went on like a little conspiracy theory, and it ended off basically talking about it's all down to, from my point of view, all down to money, because the Windrush generation are due pensions.
What? Yeah. They're Jews.
Yeah, yeah,
and money.
So yeah, so there's an art.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, when you realise how much depth goes into storytelling, especially does it make you watch TV and films differently now?
I do. I'm a massive Fraser fan.
Oh yeah.
And now I look when I watch Fraser, and there's countless repeats in Channel 4. It's like I do look at TV now completely different.
Yeah,
it's no longer watching it for
instance. I remember the exact moment I started to watch films, and I was watching actors, not the character that they were playing. I won a competition when I was pretty young to go to a summer school, a drama school, and summer of 94. And the first film I saw when I came back home from this week, or might have been fortnight, at the Oxford School of Drama, and Arachnophobia was on the television.
Wow.
And it just started, and I just started to look at this guy as an actor pretending to be somebody, and I was evaluating the quality of how well he was doing it rather than from before that day. They were the characters. They weren't actors. They were a doctor. They were a scientist. And part of you is gone forever after that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Part of the, because you're always seeing the cogs. And the great actors obviously hide their working, whereas the less good ones show their here's some acting for you.
Yeah, you're right.
And the trick is to always, just like a joke, I think, you know, it's as stand-ups, you know, unless you're a one-liner merchant, you're hiding jokes. You're hiding them in stories and stuff. So they look like the punchlines are effortless, but actually, obviously they're not effortless. You've worked very hard to sew them in.
I actually get off the fact that when I'm in front of an audience, especially a club, and I get off the quietness of the audience. Now.
Yeah.
We're before, like we're told, just when you're in the club, bang, 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 gang, gang. Now it's like I get off the fact of I'm going to bring you into my world, and the fact of now it's like I know you're listening. And you're taking in what I'm saying. That you're in my world, and and when the punchline, when I deliver the punchline to you, you're going to appreciate what I've done to you instead of just ramming it down your throat.
You're commanding silence.
Yeah. And that is down to, I would say, partly to do with obviously maturity of me as a comedian, but just the fact of being in a writer's room and painting pictures and actually for the first time looking at comedians who I admire, seeing what their qualities really is. So it's like, okay, then why do I really like Dave Chappelle? Why do I like people like Bernie Mac? What is it about Dave Allen? Apart from him, like, they're all funny, but there's got to be more than them. They've painted pictures in their stand-up and scenarios. So it's just like, well, that is what I have to do with my comedy.
They're master storytellers. That's
that's
the difference, isn't it? They can do both. That's why I think, you know, a lot of the big comedy actors that then, like Jim Carrey was then when it's drama was fantastic. It's that same difference, I think. It's that you can do both. If you can master comedy in that way, you can also master the drama.
I actually got a really massive admiration for Jack D as well. I think Jack D is a quite good actor. From what I've seen him in the little roles he's played, I think that he's transferred over that pretty well. I mean, you've seen comedians who've gone to the acting roles, like, play the same roles, but it's like, well, you're not really pushing yourself, are you?
Mm.
You're a rapper actor.
Rap actor.
Yeah, rap actor, yeah, rap talk.
So do you think you'll be also writing some stuff as well, maybe?
Yeah, I'm in the middle of doing my own show, Quincy Single Mum. And I've done that show in 2009 in Edinburgh, which was my first kind of storytelling. And it got a little wave, but I believe things are not its time.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't for its time, regardless what avenue I was going in my life. But I think now, because when I wrote it, because I've raised my son, it's about me raising my sons and losing my partner. And it's that journey of me, because I'm a lad, finding my feminine quality. And I think that analogy alone works for me, because when people hear me say stories, tell stories and deliver different pictures of, I talk about different people and characters, when they see my size is unexpected. So it gets them listening more. So now I went back to that story of, because my boys are of age, my oldest son is 25, and my youngest is 22, boy is 22, and my daughter is 17. So it's like, I talk about from, the first show was about the phase of raising them, now they're young adults, and the impact of what it's like, because they left home, and they've come back. So obviously through current climates, and it's how I still question myself as a parent.
Yeah.
So this is what I'm writing about currently now.
Which is this a
show?
Stand-up show?
Stand-up show, yeah.
Would you be taking it to Edinburgh this year as well?
No, I won't be this year, no. Yeah. I'm not really a big... No, I'll take that back. I think Edinburgh is a great concept, and I think... But I disagree with the ethos and what Edinburgh stands.
Mm.
The rigmarole to put shows on, I think that is financially unnecessary. And I think that in this day and age of social media... you don't need Edinburgh like you did before.
Mm.
And I've seen too many comedians and people who get on TV through popularity. The only difference is Edinburgh is the mecca for it's the home of performance. So you would get grassroots actors who love for acting, compared to someone who's acting in front of a iPhone. Scott, some of the people, I don't know about you, but some of the people I've seen who are like, I don't even call them YouTube stars. They get like mega deals on the fact of just doing.
Yeah,
and they offer TV shows.
Yeah,
I've seen it in action. So I was out in LA for a bit, and I've been in that room when people have been talking about and looking over social media presences of people that aren't really actors, and saying how many people follow them for possible castings. I've seen that. It's a very real. There's a good thing of. Luckily, I was at that time. I was working with people who will consider those things because that's just the environment. But they would then eventually make the decision of that. Let's just get someone good.
Good.
That's
the
way it worked out. Thank goodness. But. It's there and it's on a platter and everyone thinks about it and everyone's working on it. They do consider it. Even if you're good, they consider it now.
Yeah, I think it is. I was at a panel thing with some casting directors and they say now it's they were saying they were obviously defending their craft as a casting director, picking the right people. They were saying we would never bring anybody who's rubbish just because of the social media presence, but. If the room is split on somebody and it's between one person and another, the social media presence could be the tipping point. If everybody's completely split, they can't make their minds up, this guy or this guy, we look and one guy tweeted once 6 months ago and the other one has 20,000 followers, decision made.
I go by Dapper Laughs, you know what I mean? This guy was given a TV show on the back of his social media presence.
Built on social media.
And this is where, obviously, what he does on social media is for that platform. obviously to transfer that on TV is a different kettle of fish, but this is when you get your experienced comedians or creative writers to, obviously the guy's got something, so why not put experienced people or people of knowledge of know-how around him to build that brand.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's a lot of big actors in Hollywood who aren't great actors, but they're very big because there's just something about them people really like.
Yeah, like ability, yeah.
Yeah, so you get all these other people on board to prop them up and they'll probably get the most kudos, but really it's the directors or the writers, I'm definitely going to say again writers, or other actors that support them. You know, it's kind of the way it's been, but we definitely are living in a state of, like you were saying about politicians earlier, popularity and marketing. You know how people say money's the root of all evil? I actually believe it's marketing.
Yeah.
Marketing through it all.
I mean, that goes back to the conversation of like the quality of like people around you. What you watch as writing now, you know, watch a TV show or film, I look at it different. So I remember Rambo, the first Rambo, with Sylvester Stallone. Now, when I watched it first time, it's like, oh, this guy's killing everybody. This is a bad movie. This is dangerous. And then you look back at it, and the real drive of the first Rambo is the policeman. He has the encounter with on the bridge, and it's his journey and his ego, and you follow the emotional arc of that character, and it brings out, I forgot the guy's name, he's well known actor, I forget his name, but Sylvester Stallone is not a great actor.
He's a great writer though.
Yes, he is.
He's a great writer.
He is, I'm looking for that. You know what I mean? Anybody, the Rocky III, the Rockies and that, but he's very clever. He has people around him.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, like a football team, you know what I mean? If you take a decent enough footballer, a shit footballer, and you put him around superstars, he's going to bang in goals.
Yeah.
Or look good until you put him in, you've got to drive this. And
you've got to think of any of that stuff, really, as a team, haven't you? Because essentially they are bringing something to the table that everyone else on that team who's great at the craft might not be good at. You know, everyone might be great at craft, but they don't bring the audience. So yeah, without that person, it doesn't.
I can totally identify with that. You know what I mean?
It's annoying.
Yeah. I mean, as comedians, we've got massive egos, and because how the hell this person gets so massive? This shit. And now I can, and then it's that whole thing is that you can have all the talent in the world, but sometimes you have to ask yourself that question: are you moving with the times?
Yeah.
What is it about? You have to look at yourself as an individual. I looked at myself. I've had to I'm reinventing myself because I'm not from that social media form. I've seen guys who have bought in the game like go past me, and it's like I don't grudge them for it. I'm happy for them. I always say to them, when you reach that level, just make sure you know your craft, because you've got to deliver now. Because as quick as they find you, as quick as they will get rid of you, if you don't pull in those numbers. So, I mean, that's as far as the one thing that we've probably got over most new comics, that if we do a TV show and it doesn't hit, so back to the circuit. Yeah. I can even hear that.
It's something lovely about being a gigging comic, being a club comic. I come from, family-wise, I come from an army background, but professional-wise, I came from theatre to stand-up.
Mm.
And the acting world is so, it's been well documented on television, in newspapers, how it's become very classist and very Eton biased. But it's all, but you are just sort of waiting to be picked often as an actor, you're waiting for the phone to ring. And there's something a bit sort of more blue collar, more working essence. As long as you've got about an hour's worth of jokes in your head and a working car, you can work as a stand-up. You can just go on the road and you go from 80 quid gig to 80 quid gig, or if you're lucky, a little bit more. And you can earn a living, whereas you can't do that as an actor. You can't wander around the country doing a bit from Hamlet in every bar. Not going to work.
I'd leave that bar.
I never forget my first comedy review by my man Mr. Bennett, and he said that he will make a living from the circuit.
Probably said it as an insult as well, knowing
Steve. It might have. I've never had no massive issue with him, I suppose, but when he wrote that, I never really understood. Like, I thought, oh, he's thought I'm a good comic. Mm. But obviously now it's looking at, well, I don't know how he thinks, but was he saying it because that's the only thing I'm good for? Mm. And it's actually, you look at that comment now, it's still up there. And the chort is that, well, I'm bigger than a club comic.
Mm.
And it's like that thing of, like I said, I'm in the middle of changing my, I'm rebranding myself, basically. So is that I have to reinvent myself. I'm more than just a club comic. There are certain stages in your career you've got to have as well. You've got to respect the likes of the Michael McIntyres and the Jimmy Carrs, and because they used, and Eddie Murphy's, they used their platform and spreads like a bit like musicians. Artist Pink got into R&B because she realised that R&B was the most listened to music at the time. She got her name with some big R&B producers, got tracks out there, killing it. This one little white girl who's singing black music, it's got an amazing voice, amazing body, singing great hooks. And then once she got that popularity, she's right now, I'm going to sing what the fuck I want to sing.
Mm.
So she's singing, she's a rock star. Mm. And, you know, I love Pink, I'm sorry.
Great voice, body, great hair.
I've met Pink. This is one of the few occasions that I've genuinely been utterly star, and I knew nothing about her before. You know, I mean, I knew she was a star, but you know, I didn't listen to it. I didn't own any of her music or anything. And at the time, I was working on the Thames doing VIP speedboat trips to the O2. So we drove a lot of celebrities, the Kings of Leon and loads of bands. Simply Red, even, you know. You know, so I was very used to giving a safety briefing to a famous person for how to use their life jackets and all that sort of stuff. And Pink was just the most charismatic person that I think I've ever met, and she did not stop asking me questions the whole way there. What's this building? When was this bridge built? And I was like, you're going to go and perform to 30,000 people and you're quizzing me on the history of St. Paul's Cathedral. And when we were waiting for her after the gig at the end of the pontoon, she was like, right, I've got more questions. It was like, it wasn't even like she'd done a gig. She wanted to learn more. She just played, this massive gig.
I picked it up on an interview, a couple of interviews I saw of her. She's just so real.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's as to, you know what I mean? I say it again for the record, she's gorgeous.
just in case the record wasn't down.
Yeah. She's one of our over 30,000 listeners. Yeah.
She's amazing. I think she's gorgeous.
If Pink wants to follow you, you are on Twitter as?
Quincy Comedian.
And
Instagram, Quincy Comedian.
Cool.
Website, Quincy Comedian.
And the Single Mum show is coming back?
It's coming back, so I'll be doing previews around September time. I've doing shows in between them, Quincy Comedy Lounge shows in Stratford East, so you can check me out there. I'm always around the circuit, up and down the country, which I'm blessed. And yeah, I'm just delivering my new style of comedy.
Your changed style?
My new
storytelling
style of comedy. Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, enjoying it.
Thanks very much for doing the podcast.
I appreciate it. It's just all right. Blessed, mate.
Hope to have you down here at the club again soon.
In about 2 months. A month, sorry, June.
You can check the dates of when Quincy is here on backyardbar.co.uk.
Respect.
Thank you. Thank you.